I live by a philosophy of there's always a way. There's always a way. You know, someone says no to you. How do you turn that into a yes, or how do you get a yes from someone else? There's always a way.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of the Entrepreneur Experiment Podcast with me, Gary Fox. If you're an entrepreneur or you want to own your own business, this is the podcast for you. Each week, I chat to incredible entrepreneurs and find out their stories and secrets. This week, I'm chatting to Rena Maycock, the founder and CEO of Kilter Technologies. You know when they talk about actresses or actors and say they're a triple threat? They can sing, they can dance, they can act. Rena is that in entrepreneur form. She has an incredible range of skills and businesses. She's a business columnist with The Currency. She's the founder of Kilter, as I already said. She's also on the Commission on Taxation and Welfare. And she's also the founder of a matchmaking agency. See, you didn't think I was going to say that, did you? This is usually wide-ranging chat. As you can imagine, we talk about everything from the cost of a patent to Rena's philosophy on life. It's an incredible chat. Hope you're going to enjoy this one. First off, a quick shout out to my sponsor, Sage. As an entrepreneur, you need to be leveraging tools and software to run your business as smoothly and efficiently as possible. That is why I'm delighted to partner with Sage for this season of the pod. Sage is the global market leader for technology that helps small and medium businesses perform at their best. To learn more about Sage, go to sage.com or click the link in the pod description. Rena, welcome to the pod.
Thank you for having me, Gary.
I am delighted. I know this is going to be a good episode. The crack we've had off mic, if that'll translate, it's going to be a great episode.
No pressure then.
No pressure, just setting it up. Rena, introduce yourself.
Well, my name is Rena Maycock. I'm the CEO and founder of Kilter Child Protection Software. So we are developing child protection software for smartphones that detects and blocks cyberbullying, grooming, and suicide and self-harm content in messaging apps.
Pretty deep.
Yeah, it's full on.
You have the best Twitter bio I think I've read in a very long time. I'm going to read it out because it's that good and people should go follow you as well.
Oh, God.
Founder of Kilter Child Protection Software, columnist at The Currency and co-founder of Intro Matchmaking. Random, right?
Random indeed. I actually should edit that and say member of the Commission on Taxation and Welfare just to complete the complete it and confuse everyone.
I'm not even sure where to start with you, if I'm very honest. You pick where we start. We'll go with the matchmaking because that's going to grab people first, I think.
Oh, my word. Okay. So my background is in sales. I'm a salesperson by trade and I used to run radio stations. And then around 2008, so we launched two radio stations, one in 2007 and one in 2008. And then into the teeth of a recession. So it couldn't be a worse time. And things weren't great in broadcasting at that stage. Everybody was cutting their budgets. Mm. You know, non-discretionary or discretionary spending was all being cut. So, you know, I could see, and certainly my husband, then boyfriend Fergal at the time, was working in property sales, and both industries were kind of tanking. So we decided that we wanted independence and we wanted to set up a business, and we didn't quite know what to do. And then the idea came to us to start a matchmaking agency. And there were a couple of kind of introductions agencies in Ireland. In truth, you know, we wanted an idea that was low capex to set up. There's a lot of practicality went into this.
I was just going to ask you.
Yeah, it was a practical decision and convenient. And we could leverage our skills. You know, I had run businesses. We both came from a sales background. We'd worked with people. You know, I'd worked primarily with business people selling advertising in my early career. And Fergal had dealt with the public. So we thought, you know, matchmaking was a perfect idea. We were a little bit romantic at the time. We kind of thought, won't it be great just organizing dates for people, making people's dreams come true? This is going to be magical. It wasn't magical. We learned very quickly that people are hard to deal with. Now, they're great. 95% of them are fantastic, but then the small 5% that aren't. And that's, you know, taught me some valuable lessons about consumers. But the business went from strength to strength very quickly. We could sustain ourselves full time and then grew the team. And it's kept growing. Thank goodness. You know, we had kind of an average growth of about 29% year on year for about 8 years. And we've had two price increases in the last 2 years. And we've, well, when I say we, Fergal runs the business now and the team in there. They're rolling out a franchise model to scale the business beyond Ireland. So it's a model that's gone from strength to strength. It's recession proof. It's pandemic proof. And, you know, then a few years ago, I came up with the idea for Kilter. And
it's quite a switch.
Quite the switch. Yeah. Yeah. It came in tandem with me becoming a parent. I remember I was either pregnant or had just had my son, and I kept being sort of the image of Alan Kurdi. Do you remember the little Syrian boy that washed up on the beach in Turkey?
Oh,
yes. It was
yes.
a really yeah. harrowing image. Yeah. And I don't mind admitting I kept crying. I found it very, very difficult to deal with. So I looked around for a filter on social media so I could keep using Facebook and Twitter, and I couldn't find one. Mm. And becoming a parent as well, I became particularly, my senses were very heightened to headlines of children that had been systematically cyberbullied, groomed, coerced, extorted from. And there was one common thread, and that was the parents didn't know there was a problem until it was far too late. Mm. So, you know, intro at the time, very successful business. It was chipping away nicely. And I started to think to myself, perhaps there's something in this filter business. I spoke to a friend who's a technologist, and he said, what you're talking about, it seems to be a really natural fit for a parental control. Why don't you look into that space? So I looked into the parental control market, and I found that what's available to parents is all apps. So apps are downloaded retrospectively onto phones. There was about 250 on Google Play, maybe 220 on Apple. And they all shared the same kind of features. They had geofencing and geo-tracking so you could find your child. They had porn blocking so that you could, you know, stop your child from looking at porn. And they had access restrictions to stop your child getting addicted to their phone. But nothing was dealing with kind of cyberbullying, grooming, or suicide and self-harm. And I was thinking, am I the only parent that's terrified of this? Now, my kids were only infants at that time. But at the same time, I was thinking, children are getting phones younger and younger these days. And that march of technology is not going away. It's only getting more stronger, and kids are getting phones younger. 25% of six-year-olds have their own smartphone.
Wow.
So I spoke to my friend. He said, look into that market, looked into it. So there was nothing dealing with cyberbullying, grooming, suicide and self-harm. So I looked into the studies to see if I was the only one that was worried about that. And there was a web-wide study that had been done by the Irish government at the time that found that parents had four main equal concerns when they gave their child a smartphone. That they'd access pornography, they would be groomed, they'd be cyberbullied, or they'd spend too much time online. So the pornography and spending too much time online was being super served by the parental control app space. But the cyberbullying and grooming wasn't being addressed at all. So the salesperson in me is thinking, if you build it, they'll come. And I was thinking, why is nobody doing this? Like 50% of parents' needs aren't being met. And when I looked into the technology of it, I realized nobody was doing it because it's hard. So I started to teach myself about the tech and figured out that the earliest point in the technological stack that you can access all incoming and outgoing data, because grooming and cyberbullying is done in the main on messaging apps. And a lot of them are encrypted.
Okay.
So apps operate on a peer-to-peer system. So if you download NetNanny or Custodio or any of the other parental controls that are available on the App Store, they operate at the application layer alongside TikTok, WhatsApp, Telegram, Snapchat, you name it. So they have the same level of permission. So they can't access each other. So okay. NetNanny and Custodio, all those parental control apps, can't look inside other apps. Therefore, they can't detect harmful content. So the earliest point in the tech stack that you can access all incoming and outgoing data is the kernel level of the operating system. So getting back to the hard bit, apps have autonomy. If you have a parental control app, you can launch a version to the App Store of your solution. And you can use the money that comes in to put back into the business and fund incremental improvements to your product.
I get you.
We rely on being embedded into the smartphone at the manufacturing point because it can't be downloaded over the air and it can't be uploaded retrospectively.
Okay.
So
it's much different.
In a way, it's a much better model in that we come on the device. And our model is B2B, so we license to high volume repeat order customers in the telco space, like the Vodafones and the Trees and the Airs. Whereas if you have an app, you are selling B2C. Mm. And investors don't like B2C because scale is really sluggish and really costly. But it's getting over that kind of that reliance upon a B2B partner, even though the arguments for this are very compelling across all stakeholders in the telco value chain. You know, Google are highly motivated to solve this problem at arm's length. The OEMs, the handset manufacturers, particularly the Android ones, are exhausting all their differentiating features. So they need USPs.
Okay.
And telcos, they need USPs as well, because they're at risk of becoming mere data providers. So they need to stand out. And they're all quite eager. You know, we find that we're kind of pushing an open door. They're all quite eager to be seen to be trying to tackle this problem of harmful content coming over their network at children. So that's, you know, we, even though we have had this model and it has to be fit at the factory fit point, we weren't deterred. And I decided to become a tech startup founder. So the advice was at the time was patent first, build later.
Okay.
So we did. Took on a patent attorney, got our patent through the United States Patent and Trademark Office, got that granted.
That's how hard is that actually? Because that's something people have kind of asked quite a bit, or it's come up in previous conversations with people. How hard is it to get a patent?
It's pretty hard. You have to go through a few different iterations. You know, you have to get your proper patent attorney. Something I learned about patent attorneys is they're not regular solicitors. They're technologists.
Okay.
In the main. First, and then they are specialists in the law around technology. So, you know, you get the right trademark and patent attorney, or patent attorney rather, and you'll navigate the process reasonably quickly. You know, we chose to get our patent granted in the States because, for a few reasons, you can get what's called a track one filing, so you can get your patent granted quicker in terms of process than you can anywhere else. We ultimately want to exit to a US headquartered company, so it was important for us to have that patent. If you want US VCs to talk to you, you've got to have a patent. You know, that's your entry criteria if you want them to take you seriously. And if you get your patent granted in the United States, you can avail of what's called a patent protection highway. So they have these agreements with other patent and trademark offices in other jurisdictions like Canada, Australia, okay, places like that, where the assumption is if you've gone through the rigor of the US system, they kind of trust that the due diligence, if you will, yeah, has been done. And you've proven novelty, and you've proven that you're advancing the technology beyond the state of the art, and that the US guys have done their ecker, if you like, and they will just kind of take that as given, and they'll grant a patent to you. So that's the reason we went to the US first. But really, the reason we had to get the patent was because probably our biggest threat from an IP infringement perspective is our customers. So if you want to have a conversation with your customer, if we want to go and talk to Vodafone, or if we want to talk to Samsung, we would have to go through this lengthy NDA process so that we could be sure they weren't going to take our idea, and they could be sure we weren't going to accuse them of taking our idea. So if you have the patent, all of that kind of lengthy NDA process is somewhat done away with, because you've already got your idea protected.
Lovely.
And the doors are open then for these big commercial conversations to happen.
Nice.
So it is important. And then, you know, investors like the fact that you've gone through the rigor of proving novelty as well. It means they don't have to. You know, if you are basically saying that the officials, the examiners in the US Patent and Trademark Office have gone through what's there, and they've challenged your claims, all of your claims, and they've granted you this, there's a huge level of comfort for investors that there is indeed novelty there. Because as far as they're concerned, you're a founder, you could say mass. And, you know, they have to test out everything, you know. But once you've got this patent, it's great. Now, a lot of investors will see a huge value, a monetary value in the patent. And that's true in some cases. You know, but certainly it lays the groundwork for patent clustering, which is ultimately what you kind of need if you want a valuable patent portfolio that's, you know, that's enforceable, that's worth selling. But at least getting one is it's putting a stake in the ground.
Yeah. Is it an expensive process?
Yes, it's very expensive. If I were to, you know, hazard a guess, if you were to go for a patent, you would need to budget in the region of around 50 grand.
Wow.
And that's quite modest. You know, every jurisdiction you pick, there's more fees. There's application fees, there's examination fees. There's the patent fees for your patent representation in that particular country. You know, for instance, we had to go through this process in South Korea, in Japan, Australia. So you're talking about very different expertise in each country on how to navigate their local systems. So you've got to pay for that. None of it comes for free, and it's all very specialized.
I get you.
So, and then it doesn't end there. You know, there's maintenance fees. You have to, you know, keep up those maintenance fees. You don't have to just pay us to do the patent. You've got to pay us to keep it filed.
Oh, you got to keep it going. Okay.
You got to keep it going.
Wow. Yeah. That's really interesting though, to find out stuff like that. I love when we actually get insights like that, where you kind of go, okay, that's a rough idea for someone who's starting out in the journey, or maybe has started and needs to kind of get it a bit more protection. What was your next step when you got the patent? What did you do next? Or how did you even stepping back from that, as a non-technologist, how did you make this become a reality?
Yeah. So we grew the team, took on a CTO, developed our prototype, and we decided to prove it working on WhatsApp first, because we knew if we said, oh, here we are filtering SMS messages, we knew the first thing that would be said to us would be, okay, that's great, but what about encrypted messages? Because even a couple of years ago when we put the prototype together, you could see that there was legislation coming down the track that was eventually going to force big tech to deal with harmful user-generated content. And the majority of the legislation was around dealing with illegal content as opposed to harmful content. There's two distinct differences. You know, with illegal content, you're talking about kind of child pornography material, that kind of stuff. Whereas harmful is, it's more, you know, subjective. You know, it's cyberbullying, it's coercion, it's, you know, promoting suicide and self-harm, that kind of thing. But legislation takes an awfully long time to come in. So even though the Digital Services Act was being mooted at the time, you know, the Online Safety and Media Regulation Bill, the Harmful Content Bill, all aimed at, you know, ultimately forcing big tech to remove harmful content. And, you know, with GDPR style fines, you know, monstrous fines, enormous, like 20 million or 5% of turnover, that type of thing, fines too high to absorb as a cost of doing business. So ultimately, big tech will have to come out with these solutions to deal with this content. But none of the legislation compels big tech to deal with encrypted content, because they can't. They can't look inside it. So when all this legislation comes, harmful, bad actors are not going to slither away and die. They'll just move to encryption. And that's already started to happen. So the most dangerous places for kids to be is in encrypted apps, because that's out of the reach of even big tech themselves. You know, they can't scrutinize what's in encryption. So we knew if we proved on WhatsApp or on SMS, it wouldn't be enough, because the first question would be, well, the future harmful content is all going to be in encrypted apps. You need to prove that. So we proved it working on WhatsApp. And we started to build out the team. Then we started to kind of go down the route of engaging with to the likes of telcos, OEMs, the likes of Huawei, Vodafone, Three, Verizon in the States, you know, were very open to us. The likes of Amdocs, you know, we started to engage with our customers, our potential customers, but we just found very quickly that we were too early. You know, we were pushing an open door, because getting back to that, you know, strong motivation from each stakeholder in the value chain, they all want a solution to this. You know, PR now is intrinsically linked to share price. It's no longer enough to say it, you know, it was the AI that done it.
Yeah.
You know, you can't distance yourself from the harm that your company does to children specifically anymore. You need to be seen to be doing something. So we know that the door is open. You know, we've gotten in at really, really high levels at telcos and OEMs, but we're just too early. So even though we had the prototype, you know, we were still a year away from a test-ready product. So we had gone as far as we could with the prototype, and we needed funding. So then we got down to the nuts and bolts of raising, and realized quite quickly when we started to engage with the, you know, the institutional investment community that ours is deep tech, but because our model is B2B SaaS, we kept getting confused from a cost perspective to develop the test-ready solution with traditional enterprise SaaS products. So if I had a euro for every time someone said to me, yeah, you need 3 million, but what could you get to market for 300 grand? It's like nothing. Nothing.
I get another couple of patents.
It's deep tech. It's totally disruptive. It's a totally different business model even than every other competitor in the market. It's B2B. It's kernel level. Totally different technology. There's an application layer. It's completely different. Wildly different.
Had you bootstrapped to this point?
Yeah. So, okay. Fergal and I, you know, have put a lot of money into the business, getting the business to this point. So when we realized that we were a raise of, you know, 3 million to get to test readiness was too fruity a raise for the VC community in Ireland, we realized that technology like ours, the expectation here in Ireland certainly is that you'll de-risk it with some non-dilutive state funding through grants or some co-funding. So we started to engage. We applied for Horizon 2020. By the time we started to apply for it, so we've had four seals of excellence, which if you're familiar with the process means extremely close, but no cigar. And we realized, by the time we started to apply, it had become so competitive because the seed money has kind of, for really deep tech, for R&D intensive startups, has kind of dried up in Europe. You know, everyone wants Series A deal flow. They want that validation. They want the first customer to pay a euro, and then it's fine. You're off to the races. You've got every single funding opportunity available to you, but it's getting to that point. So the real risk is really innovative, disruptive, R&D intensive companies that need, because R&D costs money. Anything like that, there's a real danger that these innovative companies will fall away and the startup founders will just become too exhausted with this process and just go back into working for the man. And, you know, we had this discussion earlier on, that's happening in record numbers because they're not getting the support from the traditional investment community. Not just in Ireland necessarily, but, you know, in my experience in Europe. So Horizon Europe had become so competitive, it was down to nearly like a 1% statistical success rate. So wow. You were going in, spending a lot of money on the application process. So it takes about 4 person months to put in an application.
Really?
And it's a significant investment. Significant investment. They've changed the system now to a degree in that you pass in stages. So you put a small amount of money into a stage one, and if they do kind of a triage, and if you're successful, then you get invited to stage two, and then you get invited to interview. But what they've changed it to isn't, I don't think they've achieved what they kind of set out to achieve, which was making it more manageable and more, you know, transparent and equal a process as they could have. But anyway, so we started looking for funding. We spent a lot of time looking for that non-dilutive funding to de-risk the investment opportunity. And then we got very close raised our match funding in March 2020, which is perfect timing. And then COVID happened and it all kind of fell asunder. But what we did was we used the time to strengthen the business proposition. We started to engage with stakeholders to get stakeholder endorsements, you know, child protection stakeholder endorsements, international endorsements, develop partnerships with the likes of DCU, the Anti-Bullying Research Centre, and strengthen those ties. And we've engaged with Science Foundation Ireland. So we are now in a much better position.
So potentially you might have exciting news coming. What is your plan for when or if you do a raise?
Hopefully it's not an if. Hopefully it's a very exciting news in the next coming weeks type of raise. So the first thing we'll do is obviously resource the project, but we're going to generate bespoke data sets of harmful language between victim and groomer and victim and cyberbully. So from what we know, they'll be the world's first repositories of harmful verbatim language between victims and perpetrators, either cyberbullies or groomers. And that's a really important part of the work. And, you know, to do that, we'll do a public campaign. We'll invite parents and children who have experience of this to contribute their verbatim examples of this harmful language. Then we'll supplement that with focus groups and then supplement them with interviews as well. So that's a very exciting part of the project. It's going to be very involved. So that's one of the first things that we're going to do. A part of our development process is developing our technology has two sides to it. It's got the data content filter. That's the method by which we access all the data coming into and out of the device. That's what we've got patented. But then we've got our AI-driven databases of bespoke harmful language in the three problem areas of cyberbullying, grooming, and suicide and self-harm. And developing those databases is an art form in and of itself. We need to collect the data. So a part of this big campaign, this big public campaign, is going to be inviting parents and children that have suffered from these things to submit their data, tell us their stories, tell us if they want to contribute their data through either focus groups, interviews, or even anonymously, so that we can collect bespoke data sets. And from what we know, they'll be the world's first repositories of direct victim to groomer and victim to cyberbully and vice versa language.
Incredible.
So what's out there at the moment would be, you know, from the studies that we could find, it all kind of centers around keywords or key phrases. Whereas what we are going to be doing is looking at more nuanced forms of language. To give you an example, child groomers often can follow a particular pattern. They introduce themselves to a child. They might pretend to be a friend or in a mutual acquaintance or something like that. And they'll start a conversation, befriend the child, and use, say, innocuous things like, you know, so what's your favorite subject at school? You know, what social media apps do you like using the most? All that kind of thing. And then eventually they'll build up trust in the child. They'll try and get a secret from the child. And they'll use that secret to get an image or a meeting. And once they've got one image, they use that to blackmail the child to give them, to give multiple images. So that's how it spirals. So it's quite often in the early stages of contact, these innocuous phrases that they would use in text form would never be enough to trigger a keyword solution to pick up and say, oh, there's an issue here. It's the contextual, the context is important, and the elongated threat pattern analysis is important. You know, the fact that it's come from a stranger, it's a couple of messages in a week, and once, and there's one tipping point where it gets up to, it can go up to 400 and 500 messages in a day.
Wow.
So it's volume, context, and not just content that will enable us to detect these things earlier. And we'll always err on the side of caution and go with, you know, risk false positives, so that parents can figure out very quickly whether, you know, this is a grooming message or this is a cyberbullying message or not. They will tell us and we will learn from that. You know, so one of, I suppose, the intriguing things about our solution is, so, and this is, you know, again, getting back to the reason why we need to behave with the same type of testing rigor as a med tech product, because we're dealing with children's mental health,
yes,
right? Ultimately, what we're trying to do is reduce the mental health impacts of harmful content and smartphone use on children. So we can't go to market like, you know, your traditional enterprise SaaS product with the version one and yet let the users work out the kinks. We need to go to market with as close as damn it to a perfect version. And that's human level detection efficiency. But even that's not 100%. But when we get to market, very quickly, our machine will learn really super fast. So I had a conversation with the CTO of a global news group. And they've got a particular problem with toxic comments, toxic content in their comment sections.
I was thinking of this as you explained this whole theory. I was like, there's so much crossover here between
there's
trolling
so
and toxic content. It's incredible.
And his question was, you know, how is your AI going to deal with this? Because he said, we've got all these moderators. They employ hundreds of moderators. But those moderators, so for every moderator, they're trying to deal with thousands of comments in a day from hundreds of users, if not thousands of users. And the reason our model will learn so much, so they use a combination of moderators and AI, right? We'll use AI. But for every one user we have, we've got two moderators. So if we detect that your child has been cyberbullied and we withhold that message, your child is told so that they are informed of what's going on. They always know Kiltor is filtering in the background. They're always kept informed. And this is one of the reasons why we've gotten, you know, all this child protection stakeholder endorsement, is because our solution, it encourages this collaborative approach between parent and child to online safety. So the child feels empowered and they're not pushed into secret internet use, which is the danger.
Yeah.
So if we detect your child has been cyberbullied, we block the message, we save it in a file on the phone. Your child gets a message on the screen to say, we've blocked this message. So she knows or he knows the parent has been alerted. We send you, the parent, an alert and invite you to go to the child's phone with the child and look at it together. And you tell us, is that grooming? Is that cyberbullying? Is that encouragement to self-harm? And so we learn very, very quickly from two moderators for every one detected message.
Yeah, super clever.
And that trains our algorithm.
I want to ask you a question in terms of what was it like transitioning from a bootstrapped entrepreneur, cash, you know, simple-ish transactions to this? Because it's a quantum leap from the outside looking in. What was it like for you?
It was an extraordinary learning curve. I thought I knew it all, but I came from, so I, you know, worked in radio stations and TV. In the last, you know, when we launched two radio stations in that group, I came into the company after the money had been raised. So the investors were all there. Mm. I wasn't part of that process. And when I started off with Kilter, people were like, a woman in tech? People will be throwing money at you. People have not been throwing money at me. I remember even very, very early days when it was just conceptual. I was talking to somebody in Silicon Valley, actually, and she said, send me your pitch deck. And I was like, what's a pitch deck? I mean, I've gone from not knowing what a pitch deck was to this raise. It's been enlightening, disappointing in a lot of ways, you know. I'd be quite outspoken in that way, but I've learned a huge amount. I do love it. I love the business of business. I think about it all the time, which is crippling, but it's been a real learning curve, and I've loved every second. Soul destroying as it can be, it's very, very interesting. Yeah, and I've enjoyed every second.
How did you get started in business? What was your intro to the business world?
I remember going for an interview in 98 FM, and the chief executive at the time said in the interview, so I had done media production in college, right? And I wanted to be a film editor. And when I realized that there were steps in that ladder that started with, you know, being a runner and basically cleaning for a number of years before you'd ever get to kind of, you know, touch an editing machine, I said to my mother at the time, I'm sick of earning rubbish money. How do I make money? And she said, well, you can make money in either production or sales. And I didn't know how to produce anything, so it's sales. And I had been, you know, I'd worked my way through college selling shoes, and I was always the best at that. I'm ferociously competitive. Mm-hmm. So my personality just lends itself naturally to selling. So I looked for sales jobs. And eventually I landed in the chief executive's office in 98 FM. And I probably have always been a little bit overconfident. And he said to me, you know, where do you want to be in 10 years time? And I said, I don't know, but in 5 years time, I'm going to be sitting in your seat. And I'm sure he thought I was hilarious. But it did take me the 10 years to get to the chief executive seat, but I got there. And that, you know, from that stage, I sold for a couple of years in my early 20s, but very quickly went into the management side, you know, as direct sales manager, then sales director, and then general manager, and then chief executive. I just naturally just went that way, you know, up in management positions, and eventually got to that level where it was exposure to all areas of the business. And that was the most interesting, was getting that macro view of a company, you know, where, you know, when you're a sales manager, you somewhat operate in a bit of a silo, you know. The CFO is there and they're a pain. You know, they're a nuisance to deal with because they ruin your fun when you're a salesperson. You get a little bit of experience in the marketing side, you know, because you're promoting that to your customers. But you don't have that macro view. So when I went into, you know, the general manager position, I started to get this macro view. You know, I was wearing a hard hat and I was pointing out where I wanted, you know, things to be and all that kind of stuff. And that was great fun, you know, the sheer variety and learning how it all came together, the entire business. So I never did a business degree. I just learned on the fly and loved it. And I just realized that was my thing. You know, when I went into that position, I started to get that feel and I was across all these different departments and they were kind of feeding information into me. I just absolutely loved the experience of it. Of being across all those different areas and seeing how it all knitted together. And I just, fell in love with business.
Was that the spark, do you think? Was that the kind of moment where you're like, I reckon I could do this myself. I reckon I have a pretty good idea what's going on.
Yeah, look, it's hard to say whether it was ever more carrot than stick. certainly economic conditions at that time meant that there wasn't a huge amount of, I didn't have a huge amount of autonomy. You know, those businesses that, you know, that I had been working in had been enormous beneficiaries of the Celtic Tiger. Enormous. You know, I was even discussing this with a friend the other day. I was around in radio sales when there were so many houses being sold that there wasn't enough space in the newspaper property sections anymore. And the developers had to find new ways of advertising. And all of a sudden they discovered radio stations. So, I mean, it got to a point where developers had gone from spending nothing on radio to being the biggest spenders on radio and then TV. So very different times. You know, those licenses would have been applied for and those investors would have been recruited on the basis of 2004, 2005 revenue figures, which were astronomical. I mean, at that time, all you needed to do was open the window and money flew in.
We forget this, though.
We do forget.
We're so battle scarred from the recession that that's kind of the anchor in your head going, God, that was hard. But you forget how bubbly, I suppose is the word, how crazy it was. You do forget how good things were.
I actually only had this conversation with a girl this morning who's helping us on this journey. She has a very interesting story, a very heartfelt story. And she's 20. And I was looking at her and, you know, she had been running her parents' business while her parents were away. And I thought, wow, what a capable young woman. And I said to her, when I was 20, I was flying around in a sports car, flogging advertising, just thinking I was absolutely great. I hadn't got a clue. I was an idiot. Such an idiot when I think back on it. But very much the beneficiary of that Celtic Tiger boom. It was phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal. So getting back to your points, I used to look at business people and I used to think, why would you own a business? You take all the risk. I'm not interested in risk. I want to get my pay packet at the end of the month. I want to go and buy my clothes, my cars, and not be bothered with it. I want to, you know, close the door at the end of the night and just think about what I'm going to eat, not how I'm going to run my business, you know? And that just changed. And I think it was all about agency. Okay. It was about not answering to people. It was about freedom to grow, freedom to expand, and that autonomy. You know, getting into those management positions where I started to understand how businesses worked, I just started to get really excited about it and I wanted my own.
That's really interesting. I'm always curious as to what sparks people. Generally, they've seen family members do it. That's nearly 9 times out of 10. That's where the answer comes from. But I'm always curious as to the journey. What was the journey? And often people don't talk about the realities of, I need to earn money. I think that's a reality. Mm-hmm. A lot of people, it's kind of sexy to run your own business. Oh, it's cool. Oh, you run your own hours. Class. But like we talked about earlier, you know, it's not quite that simple. And it's not the land of milk and honey that people think, oh, if you want to get rich, start your own business. Not really, you know?
No, there's a huge amount of risk involved. And I think it takes a certain type of personality. You know, I'm part of the startup community a few years now, and I've got a lot of extremely good friends in it. And we all share that. We all share that risk. We all compromise. You know, we know that if we were to go and work for the man, we'd earn 3, maybe even 4 times what we can pay ourselves in startup. But it's all about the potential. Mm. How big can I grow this?
Yeah.
I don't know why I'm telling you this. I've got an enormous fear of regret. It's actually my biggest fear, regret.
Fear of regret.
Okay. Regret. I fear regret. I don't fear anything that other people inflict on me because I don't have any control over it.
Great.
I've got control over myself. Mm. I've got control over my own decisions. And when I'm having those bad days, and every entrepreneur, if they're honest with you, has those bad days, those moments of self-doubt where you kind of go, oh my God, because losses are amplified when you're in startup. Wins are amplified in startup. They have to be. You have to refill those pots of optimism. But it's thoughts of me getting to retirement age and knowing I could have done better, worked harder, pushed more, and really got the best out of myself. Mm. I am terrified of getting to that point and thinking, I should have done more. I could have done this. I could have done that. And so I live by a philosophy of there's always a way. There's always a way. You know, someone says no to you. How do you turn that into a yes, or how do you get a yes from someone else? There's always a way. And so I suppose what energizes me probably is that fear of regret.
That's beautiful.
It's very deep.
It is.
Why are you making me say these things?
It's brilliant though. I love when people are honest, because often we don't even know ourselves. I often ask people, what's your motivation? What drives you? And often they're not sure. They're just kind of stumbling forward one step in front of the other. Mm-hmm. I think, you know what I love from someone like yourself, having an entrepreneur who's experienced on, who's done multiple successful businesses, what's really interesting is the fear stays with you. You kind of think, you've made it, inverted commas, to people looking at Rena outside going, oh my God. I only had this conversation with a friend of mine last week. I was like, you know, you're a class. Like, everyone looks at you and thinks you're brilliant. You've done this huge high profile entrepreneur. I was like, you're amazing. Look at it. But yeah, but I haven't done this, and this. I'm like, that is so interesting, because it's a common trait again that we often are unable to step outside ourselves and go, okay, you've achieved this, and this. But I haven't achieved this. It's amazing, that common trait of the push, the drive. People, they always talk about that kind of, oh, are they born or made? I'm not really sure where I sit on that side of the spectrum. I think it's a bit of both. But it's fascinating to see an experienced entrepreneur like you talk so openly about that.
It is one of those things. If I'm honest, it is fear. It's fear of not maximizing my potential. And I sound very woolly, but I suppose, you know, setting a good example for my kids. And I love the idea of a rest. I'm not going to lie, Gary. I love the idea of a rest, but I know my personality. I know I'm not cut out for resting. Yeah. That sounds like a very strange thing to say, but I've discussed it with Fergal quite a bit. You know, if you have a bad day, you'd be like, I'm just sick of this. Oh, I'd love to just retire. And he's like, you wouldn't be able to retire.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think a lot of entrepreneurs can't.
I wouldn't be able to retire.
I'd fear it. I'd hate to retire. I couldn't think of anything worse.
Yeah.
If you said, oh, I do this. I'm having fun right now doing this. I couldn't think of, this is not work for me. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs, okay, you've dated, you're like, this is just utterly soul destroying. But it's the freedom. Someone asked me last week, it was for a college assignment. They're like, why are you an entrepreneur? And I was like, oh God, I don't know. I had like 20 seconds of like deep soul searching. I was like, I don't know. I was like, it's the freedom. It's the freedom to...
It is the freedom.
Unlimited potential, you know, and it's not like the freedom to go play golf on a Monday morning. That's class two, but it's the freedom to choose, I think. It's the freedom to choose. I can choose to work this hard. I can choose to do this. What would a rest look like for you now? I'm not talking about retirement. What would you like to do as a rest? Or how do you recharge is probably a better question. The other one's probably a bit too deep. How do you recharge?
I walk 7.5 kilometers every day.
Very specific.
And that's my recharge.
Very specific. 7.5 kilometers, no more, no less.
This is very true. It's a specific route, Gary. I'm a creature of habit.
Okay.
That's my recharge. That's where I get kind of my deep thinking done. Mm. It used to be driving. I used to commute, and I used to love that thought process, just being left alone with my thoughts. It's when I came up with my best stuff. A proper rest, probably like, look, a week away with the kids, you know, that kind of thing. But I do find it very difficult to switch off.
Mm.
I wouldn't be able to leave my emails off for a week or not look at stuff. I'd be bored. I'd actually be bored in my brain. Mm. Do you know what I mean? I find that extremely, extremely tricky. But like you say, it's freedom. I always say we never have that. Like when you toy with the idea of going working for the man, you think, oh, Jesus, no. I mean, immediately it's no, because I never have that Sunday night feeling that I didn't do my acre, you know, I never have that dread.
Yeah.
My friends do. Mm-hmm. They might earn, you know, great wages, but they have that dread. They're going in, they're answering to somebody, they're competing with their colleagues for promotions. They're all of that dynamic that I said goodbye to gratefully. They've got to deal with that, you know? So yes, it is stressful being a startup entrepreneur. It is, you know, it's difficult being a business person. You know, there are up days, down days, but it's way better. In my view,
yeah.
It's just better.
We swapped the Sunday night dread for continual dread.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's broken up, isn't it? It either is for you or it's not for you. I think that that's very, very, very clear quite early. Either you thrive in it or you're like, no, I actually would prefer an hour's dread on a Sunday and then the rest of the week is relatively okay. How do you, you're involved in a ton of stuff. Mm. How do you balance it all? As in specifically, tell me the details of how do you get stuff done in a week, in a month, in a quarter? Like, what does that look like? What's your process?
So with Kilter is the full-time job and it's where the focus always is. I have two other, you know, I'm a director of Intro, but I don't run that business. Fergal runs that business along with the team. So I don't have anything to do with that. I take the odd meeting, you know, when we're talking about the, you know, the franchise model, that kind of stuff, but really I've got nothing to do with it. I've got two other gigs. I write for The Currency and I'm on the Commission on Taxation and Welfare. The Commission on Taxation and Welfare, you know, I was invited on and we meet every couple of weeks. It's very involved. But my learnings from that, it's almost like doing an economics degree. Well, what I'd imagine to be, but it's a crash course. It's all squished into every other Friday. And that's a real privilege to be on that because I get to be a voice for entrepreneurs, you know, because one of our terms of reference is how do we make Ireland a better place to start and run a business? So I am incredibly privileged to be representing all of you business people on that commission. And there's only been two others. So, and there's probably not going to be another one for another decade.
Wow.
So I'm very privileged to be on that. And then the currency kind of like, so I'm supposed to do a fortnightly column. I do one a month. I find that flows.
Okay. I was going to ask you that because I find this difficult. Sometimes I have to do some content on a Monday. I do like a kind of a solo pod. Sometimes I'm just sitting staring at the screen. I'm like, what am I going to talk about this week? So the creative process flows for you?
Yeah, it's all, my columns are also always born from a problem or something I've encountered, whether that's in Intro or other business or in Kilter. And this, you know, this process for me, as I said, has been such a steep learning curve. I find it also interesting that I really do like writing about it. And I think one of the reasons why Ian and Tom asked me to do the column in the first place was because of that weird eclectic mix of things that I have done, you know, broadcast media, matchmaking company, which is, you know, small, a micro and small enterprise. And, you know, now it's a franchise model and then the tech startup component. And it's the funding journey, all those things that people don't really like talking about. I don't mind being a mouthpiece for it because I wish I'd met me 4 years ago. When I started this journey, I wish the Rena of today sat the ignorant Rena down from 4 years ago and said, here's the shorthand. Here are all the shortcuts that you can do. Here are all the learnings that you can benefit from, and maybe you'll be able to get there a little bit quicker.
Okay, you've stolen my next question. What are they? tell me what should, because I've asked this question to people. I was making my barge this morning and I was stirring it around. I'm like, I think I'm going to change that question today. But no, you've brought it right up. So because sometimes people panic and they're like, I'm not sure what I tell myself. So you can either talk to Rena 4 years ago, or you can talk to people, actually both. I want you to talk to Rena 4 years ago, and then I want you to talk to brand new entrepreneurs with zero experience.
Okay. So to brand new entrepreneurs, I'll start with that one. Go to the opening of every envelope. You know, say yes to everything. Shake everyone's hand and make everyone meet you for a coffee. You know, don't be too proud to ask for help. I have found that that's the most important shortcut. So what I used to do back when in-person meetings and events were a thing, I used to go to them. There would be a speaker, usually. At the end, I'd put my hand up. I would introduce myself and my company, and I would ask a tenuous question. Because once I said, I'm developing child protection software for smartphones that detects and blocks cyberbullying, grooming, and suicide and self-harm, at the end of the thing, whoever could help me in the room would find me.
Yes, great.
And I wouldn't have to go and press the flesh with 60 to 100 people. And I found that was a great way to expedite things, you know, progress. Because people are helpful, you know. They will. They do want to talk to you. They do want to help you. Particularly Irish people. Most throw on the green jersey and they really want you to succeed and they'll help you out. So that would be my advice. In truth, if I could talk to myself of 4 years ago, I would say, learn how to recognize a slow no when you see one. If an investor or a VC is asking you to come to 10 meetings, if they're calling you every other day, but there's no progress, if they're just looking for you to connect them with high-powered people that are in your network, if you seem to be making no progress with them, you know, it's just conversation after conversation after conversation. Recognize that as a slow no and walk away and save your time, because it's never going to be a yes. Investors know really, really quickly if they are going to back you. In my experience, you know, from the investors that we have, they get you very quickly. They buy into you, the person, and your team. And they get your concept. They don't go on and on about reasons why they shouldn't invest in you. They don't focus on the risk. They focus on the opportunity, and you can see the excitement from them. And it's easy to see. So that's what I would say to myself. Recognize a slow no, and for the love of God, spend your time more wisely.
It's a hard yes or hard no, right? That's yeah. A good way of viewing a lot of things in life.
And you know what? I'd almost, you know, when I have meetings now, I'm very much of the frame of mind where I'm not afraid to say to the person I'm speaking to, don't drag me down a lengthy process. Just give me a fast no. Don't give me a slow no. I don't have time.
This is what I wanted to ask you. I wanted to ask you that exact question because I've had friends who go through this long drawn out process and they're not sure. They're like, should I give them a nudge? Should I not? So are you okay to just directly ask them?
When you're in conversation with them. And you know, you're getting to that point where you've done your pitch, you've taken the Q&A, you've gotten to the end of the meeting, and they say, have you any questions? Then say it, you know, please just give me a fast no. Don't drag me down a lengthy process. If you know you're not going to invest, don't. Just give me a fast no. Because it really isn't, raising is a numbers game. There's always more VCs. There are thousands upon thousands of them. There are thousands of angel investors. And you'll know very quickly. One of these things I learned in sales early on when I was in my career, I used to be afraid of the no because I used to prefer to have the pipeline.
Yes.
You know, I preferred to be
the hope.
Well, maybe they might buy. Maybe they might. You know, it's in the pipeline. It's a potential. But I realized then quite quickly that there's just no point. It's delaying the inevitable. There's no point in keeping them in the pipeline. If you know they're not going to buy from you, get rid of them. And if they are, close it. You know, ABC.
Love it.
Always be closing.
Cool. You see, almost to the last question. The last question is to recommend a book. So think about that for a couple of minutes, just as I'm asking you the final, second last question. What, you see loads of kind of trends and ideas. Is there anything, if you weren't doing Kilter, is there any other trends or ideas that are kind of grabbing your attention at the minute you think, oh, there's a lot of potential there?
Yeah. Because of the sheer complexity of this, what I've undertaken, you know, I often get drawn towards really simple ideas. like sales agencies or, you know, really obvious kind of consumer products that are easily manufactured, easy sold, you know. I won't go into too much specifics.
Oh, you got a couple other ideas bubbling. I can see it.
There's nothing going to be done with them, let me tell you. There is nothing going to be done with them. But yeah, because of the complexity of this, you know, I'm not, I certainly don't regret undertaking this journey. In a way, I'm very glad I didn't know what I was getting myself into. Because, so you've asked me to recommend a book, right? I'm not big on reading startup books and all that kind of thing. I find I get tied up in knots of it. They conflict.
A lot of it's rehashed as well. They're re-spinning the same. They're dragging out. You know, it's like the whole thing, you know, this phone call should have been an email. This book should have been a tweet. There's so many of them. You kind of read it and go, this is one idea spun out for 300 pages. You could have. It doesn't have to be a business book. Biography, anything that you've kind of, even something you've enjoyed and went, there was a good story or narrative there.
So the last business book I read was Behind the Cloud by Mark Benioff. It's an oldie but a goodie. Mm. So I suppose I was drawn to that because of the science of sales. I'm a salesperson at heart. Their journey, you know, they had a very, very disrupt, like their market, their product really disrupted the market that they were competing in. But he, one of his big things was, don't be afraid of how big your idea is. So when I came up with Kilter, like, it's a beast. It is a beast. You know, it's not an incremental improvement on the state of the art. It's a complete divergence from the state of the art. It's a total, like, people always say, don't say you have no competitors. But we don't. We don't. Like, we say we do in all of the applications we have, because it's seen as too arrogant to say that we don't have competitors. But we don't. There's alternatives. And, you know, the alternative is, don't give a child a smartphone. Put spyware on there, but means you have to look at all of their activity. It doesn't filter anything. You know, it just records all their activity. There's alternatives, but there's no competition. So our you know, Kilter is a thoroughly disruptive innovation with massive global potential, rapid global scale potential as well. So it's huge. And often it can be tempting to crumple under the weight of that and think, what have I done? I'm not capable of this. You know, I've got two kids. I'm a mom in Ireland and blah, blah, blah. I'm not going to make this big. But the one thing Mark Benioff said was, don't be intimidated by the size of the idea. Follow it. It doesn't matter if it's enormous. It doesn't matter if you get rejected by VCs. He was rejected by VCs. He raised his money in the main from angels, family and friends. Don't be afraid of the idea.
Behind the Cloud, Mark Benioff.
Yeah.
Super. Where can people learn more about you, about the company, and about the raise?
Well, they can see me on LinkedIn. I'm active on there. They can follow me on Twitter. They can try and friend me on Facebook. I won't accept because I'm very private. They can read me in The Currency, and they can find out more about Kilter on kilter.ie. Mainly LinkedIn. LinkedIn is fantastic.
Huge.
LinkedIn, again, if I was to go back and talk to my former self, or indeed any startup founder, I'd say invest in a premium LinkedIn. It's fantastic. It's the great equalizer. People will, if you message people on LinkedIn, they take you quite seriously and they will give off their time. There's a mutual understanding there. And LinkedIn has really helped me to get traction. You can, you know, it removes all the gatekeepers from really important and influential people. They don't have a secretary on there. Well, one or two did, which I found was a bit strange. But yes, it's very worthwhile. LinkedIn are going to have to actually start paying me. I might get onto them and see if I can get a commission.
There you go, code Rena 10.
They can't get all this promotion for free, Gary.
I agree with that. Huge,
not on.
Hugely underrated. Mass. I post multiple times a day in there. Has organic reach. And like you say, you can directly reach. It's the only, it's the only social media I find where you actually, it's the real person. Most of them have like people that manage it, or they don't read it, or DMs aren't on, whatever. It's the only one where you're nearly guaranteed. Rena, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Gary, for having me.
If you enjoyed that chat with Rena, go check out Kilter and go check out their crowdfunding as well. I will chat to you next Monday for the Idea Lab. Have an incredible week.